This version of the podcast is mixed in mono, but if you would like to listen in 5.1 surround sound, please visit ufocast.co.uk/prisoner for more details.
This is episode 14, but we recorded it 15th in May 2023.
Hello and welcome to this episode of By Hook or By Crook. This week we are talking about living in harmony, and joining me as ever, my co-host Michael.
Hello.
And as far as we're concerned, a returning guest, because we last spoke to him a year ago. But for you, you'll be hearing him for the first time, which will be your second time, next week. Because Tony came on to do The Girl Who Was Death. And he said, if you still got Living in Harmony lurking around at the end of the project and you haven't done it, I'll come back. And we have Living in Harmony lurking at the end of the project. So Tony is back. Welcome, Tony.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be back after another year.
An entire year. That's ridiculous.
Yes.
Right. As podcasting goes, this is just... I mean, I'm so glad we didn't just, you know, release them.
Yes, because it would have been a complete mess.
Yeah. But also, it kind of feels like actually The Prisoner, where you get episodes you're going, what is the production order? What is the actual real order? So maybe that's kind of a homage.
I think we sort of intentionally did that.
Yeah.
Well, no, we did. We said we'll do Arrival first. We'll do Once Upon a Time and Fallout last, and then everything else in between doesn't really matter what order we record it in, because it is something of a movable feast.
I didn't envisage a gigantic gap.
No, I mean, I didn't. Yes, I didn't. I didn't think. I mean, in the meantime, I've done quite a lot, and you've done quite a lot, and other things have happened. But this means that because we've already recorded with Tony. We've already recorded the usual interview that we do with every guest about why they're a big fan of The Prisoner. So we're not going to repeat that. You can listen to that next week. That's a reason to come back and hear him again, because he's very good value for money. But that means we can dive straight in with the episode. So I'm going to shut up and hand over to Tony. Why was it that when we said Living in Harmony was still available and you were like, if it's still available later on, I'll do it. Why did you take that as your second episode to talk about?
I like the Prisoner as a whole, but I particularly like, I mean, they're effectively the padding episodes, the ones that they wrote after they were suddenly asked to create another series of episodes to sell it to the Americans. But I like the most, I like the Prisoner when it's at its most. I'm going to mildly swear here. It's most batshit crazy, and I think this and The Girl Who Was Death are two of the weirdest episodes in a weird series. I mean, how people would have reacted to turning on to watch the Prisoner to the start of that episode, which gives no clue that it, I mean, you know, it's The Prisoner because it's got Patrick McGoohan in it, but it makes no attempt to pander to the audience by running the normal title sequence. It goes straight into a Western version of the title sequence. What are people made of that? I don't know. I did see on the Wikipedia page that a critic at The Scotsman, and I think this must be a later review because I never heard the phrase. It wouldn't have been a phrase at the time, I don't think. But he said that the series, he thinks the series jumped the shark with this episode.
Wow. Now, I think it must have been
because Jump the Shark, the origin of that is from an episode of Happy Days,
which is in the 70s. Yes.
Yeah. But I think the Prisoner, it's impossible for The Prisoner to jump the shark because it started 6 feet above the shark before it even began.
It was inside the shark, man.
I mean, I think if you're going to say this one is the one where it jumped the shark, I mean, surely at least the preceding episode, Do Not Forsake Me, it had already jumped the shark. And I'm sure you could make a case for it having jumped the shark at any number of points earlier in the...
I'm just flipping back through the order that we're doing them in. And, oh God, yeah.
I mean, it's interesting that you've just alluded to the whole kind of like, they would have thought, what is this? Because it doesn't start the way it's supposed to. We are recording this the week after Inside Number 9 has pulled a massive trick by pretending they were going to do a riff on the buses and then playing a quiz show with Lee Mack. And the idea was that nobody would think they were watching Inside Number 9. And then gradually, as they watch the episode, and it becomes clear that it's not a new episode of a game show. It's been very carefully scripted. And then you get to the end, and it's very obviously not real. And
which is annoying, because I really wanted to watch the On the Buses episode. I've not seen it yet, and I didn't know anything about this. I thought I'd missed the On the Buses episode, and there was another one with Lee Mack as a quiz show.
No, the On the Buses thing was apparently a complete red herring, so they could slip this in under the radar. But anyway, my point is that you just saying that, Tony, made me think that this is the Prisoner sort of doing that. I mean, obviously, it's more obviously the Prisoner because it's got Patrick McGoohan and it's got the titles, it's got the right font and everything. But until the very end...
No titles. That's the point.
No, there was a point. No, yeah. I mean, as in the title font. So it says "Living in Harmony" in the Prisoner font, and then it gives you like written and directed and all that kind of stuff. So if you know your fonts, then you're going to be like, okay, right, this is. But until the last 5-10 minutes, you have no idea what's going on.
It's nine. I timed it this morning.
It's 9 minutes of four actual. In,
right, it's a four. Well, it's 8.5 minutes. Before the number six or the sheriff goes down and then comes back up again.
Right.
And he's in his number six coat. That's the point where, for a start, there's text and people actually start saying things.
Yeah.
But that's the point where you go, and now we'll find out. I mean, I've got some stuff I'll need to say as well, but just, you're right. According to the Alex Cox thing, this episode was so off the wall that the French release first time round didn't show it, and there were lots of American companies didn't show it either, just as the run. So it was only 16 episodes, not 17.
Well, and this was the one they decided not to play.
And this is the one they decided not to play. Some people blame the drugs, because there's drugs mentioned, but quite clearly, Tony's right, it's the one where you would just go, they're just going to think we've cancelled The Prisoner and replaced it with a Western. If you're, they're always pandering to the casual viewer.
Yeah,
not the people who've invested, especially at this point in history. So, that's it.
No, I think that works. Do you like westerns, Tony? Is that part?
I love westerns. It's part. I like westerns of all, like spaghetti westerns as well as old school American westerns. I think it's a very underestimated genre because they turned out a lot of films. There is a lot of, not trash, but a lot of very average westerns. But the best westerns are the best among the best films ever made. And I just think they get overlooked because it's seen a bit like science fiction and actually in fantasy. That it's seen as a genre rather than as a sort of as part of the general art form of cinema and TV. I mean, it was dominant. I did some research because I was going to write something called The History Behind the Historicals. I was going to write an article about the gunfighters historical reality of the gunfighters versus the television version.
We're talking Doctor Who here, for those listeners who aren't into Doctor Who. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've done a lot of research into, I mean, westerns were ubiquitous on television at this point. They were ubiquitous on, I mean, they were ubiquitous on television until my childhood. My nan loved westerns. We'd watch westerns at my nan's house, my nan and granddad's quite a lot too, when I was younger. They had films on, but they had TV series. It was the most recognisable, obvious genre on TV, even in the UK. Mm. So if they were going to pick anything to do an episode like this, westerns is actually probably a sensible choice.
That makes sense. I mean, I think, and I, cards on the table here, I don't enjoy this episode. I may even go so far as to say it's my least favourite of the series, though we haven't recorded A Change of Mind yet, which you listeners will have heard a couple of weeks ago, and it may be that one ends up being my least favourite. My recollection is that I don't particularly enjoy that one. But I suspect that my lack of enjoyment of the episode is as much a comment on my enjoyment of westerns as a whole, as it is a comment about this episode of The Prisoner. Because thinking, you alluded to sci-fi, if they'd gone full out sci-fi, like if they'd done like The Prisoner in space,
a Star Trek episode
of The Prisoner, or if they had done a time traveling episode of The Prisoner, for example, to kind of pick a couple of obvious sci-fi tropes that they could have done, but with the same idea of they're making him hallucinate and putting him in that environment is another way of trying to make him crack, I would probably go, well, yeah, fine, I'll go with it. But I think just because I don't really enjoy westerns, I mean, I've seen The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and I kind of appreciate it as a piece of cinema. I can kind of go, okay, yeah, I can see how this works. And I love Back to the Future 3. Like, if you were like, what's a western that you actually like? Well, I'd go for that one. But that's obviously got a huge dollop of Back to the Future in it.
I would recommend, if you were going to go down that road, trying the new True Grit.
Ah, okay.
Right. It's. Yeah, I won't say much more than that. For me, if you were looking for a modern route in, and you wanted to avoid the exciting world of John Wayne and all of the baggage that goes with that,
yeah,
then for me, that's something I would suggest as an option of having a look at. But
okay.
If you don't enjoy westerns, you just don't enjoy them. But I mean, like Tony says, it's such a broad thing.
I've seen a few, and
there's your classics, and then there's the standard background noise of it.
Yeah, I do like the gunfighters. I like as a Doctor Who episode, I like the gunfighters.
Well, I was about to say it should be noted that The Prisoner isn't even particularly original here, because Doctor Who has done a western episode at this point, and Star Trek has a western episode of sorts, which is also set at the gunfight at the OK Corral. Right. So, I mean, the Star Trek one is a bit much weirder than the Doctor Who one, but it's not even a particularly original choice in a way. Every science fiction series, the two of the biggest science fiction series of all time have both done a western episode in their run.
So let's narrow in on this then. What is it about Living in Harmony as a prisoner episode as a western? What is it that you particularly enjoy?
Well, I like the fact that it does stick with a lot of the tropes of a traditional western. There's a good guy who refuses to. I mean, the prisoner is effectively in some ways like a western anyway, because the hero is solid, doesn't bend in any way whatsoever, and is motivated by his With The Prisoner, with number six, you never quite know what his motivation is apart from his refusal to be made to do something. He's just bloody-mindedly not going to do what they want him to do, regardless of what they put him through. Number six isn't in prison with them. They are in prison with him. And it's him that breaks the number twos, and it breaks the... In this one, the bad guy's break is much more an actual psychological break. Number two doesn't, but the Alex Kenner character does, the kid, break psychologically, but he's broken them, not them breaking him. And I think that's quite an interesting take on the... And I like in the fact in this episode, he does refuse to carry a gun, even though they try and make him carry a gun. Yeah.
But there's one scene where he picks up the gun and checks it, and there's no bullets in it.
Yeah.
It's as if he's about to use it, and they've already taken the teeth away from the gun. They've left the gun in the cupboard, in the chest of drawers, whatever it is, the office desk. But he gets it out and he checks it. No bullets in there. And on a tiny screen, it does look like he's got bullets in the bandolier, but in fact, they're just metal studs. You're completely right to the whole... I mean, they're trying to bend his will.
It's fine. I'll come back to that. Go on, Tony.
I will say the countryside outside the town doesn't look anything like America, it does look like they're riding around on Hampstead Heath.
It's the whole Austin Powers thing, but the other way around. When he goes, yeah, isn't it funny how California looks in no way like the British countryside? It's completely the other way around, word for word. So yeah,
which makes more sense when you realise it's a film set, it's a fake. In the episode itself, it's a fake set. I love the fact that they actually went to the lengths of building a fake set next to the village,
next to the hospital.
Yeah,
because he's looking down.
Who does the set building there? Is there a team like of?
Oh no, there definitely is a team of people who just wheel stuff in.
But was that? I mean, this is the other thing. Do you know this, Michael? Was that a standing set?
Yes.
Was that like a Western set that they used to like other Westerns?
It is, but it's all, I think, according to the Alex Cox book again, it's the same redressed set that's used in The Girl Who Was Deaf.
Oh.
Yeah, it's still the same back lot.
What, for the village?
Yeah. Not the village back.
No,
yeah.
As in the village he goes to.
Yes,
and has the fight with the girl.
That's what's said in the Alex Cox thing. It's just redressed,
okay. Right?
You can kind of see it when you see it.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering whether because it vaguely reminds me of the bit of the studio that Ed Straker drives around with his son in Equestrian Priorities and UFO.
Definitely.
And I don't know whether a few years later it might be in the same place.
Right.
Yeah. It might. Sorry.
No, I was just about to say, my question is because, I've got this ongoing theory about Star Trek. Star Trek Next Generation episodes fit into three categories. You've got space, you've got mind episodes, and you've got holodeck episodes. And for me, my initial thoughts were, oh, this is just the holodeck episode. You've got the same people, but they're in a new location.
Yes, yeah.
Because the majority of The Prisoner is arguably a mind episode, because that's like, oh, it's personality changing and all that business. But this is quite categorically people pared down to their innate driving forces shoved in a new location.
Yeah.
And like, I'd forgotten that Star Trek had already done their Western story as well. So that totally threw everything into split. But is this, and this is your area of expertise, Luke, actually The Prisoner's dream episode?
Oh, well,
because I know...
Dreams are my... Yeah. Is that because I'm so critical of Gerry Anderson doing dream episodes?
Yeah, exactly. It's Gerry Anderson.
Well, no.
This must be the dream episode.
No, that's not that's not true. I dislike Ordeal.
But
that is
actually, very true.
But actually, most of the puppet dream episodes I enjoy. I think Attack on Cloud Base is brilliant. Tom Thumb Tempest is fantastic. This is very much not a dream episode because... a dream episode is just one of our well-known characters falls asleep and dreams stuff, and because it's a dream, you can do stuff to them that, like, and often kill them, and then they wake up, and you can put them in fantastical situations that you otherwise wouldn't do. Whereas this one is very clearly, physically he's there, physically he's running around, and this is the interesting thing, because at the moment he wakes up, there's a cardboard cutout of number two, right? And then there's nobody else there. And so you're then like, oh, so how much of it was a hallucination? Because he's got the headphones on, he's got the microphone on, and the brief explanation...
And how do they know what he's seeing?
Well, yeah, the brief explanation that we get is we've pumped him full of hallucinogens and we've talked to him, right? So the implication is, like... were any of the other people ever actually there?
Mm.
I mean, it seems because the kid and Kathy go back to it that they probably were. But also, in that case, why is there the cardboard cut out of the horse? And why is there the cardboard cut out of number two?
I was actually thinking today, that cardboard cut out of the horse is a gigantic photographic blow-up. It probably cost as much as a horse to do. Because in order to get a blow-up that big...
Yeah.
And that 2D...
But I love that shot.
That is a beautiful shot, because the camera's there, you see it.
Yeah,
and it looks
like,
3D,
oh,
and then
what?
It goes sideways. Yeah. Oh, nice, so, gorgeous.
So what do you think, Tony? Does it really... Because for me, it's like, does it really matter? But like, do you kind of unpick that and go, well, what was actually real and what wasn't real? And
I think they were talking to him. I think this is one of the reasons why the kid doesn't actually speak almost at all in his encounters with Number Six, because I think the kid is doing the real person that is the kid is doing the narration of the story and is feeding the information into and that the judge and the I can't remember what the woman's called in it,
Kathy.
But Kathy are both doing their parts, and there's probably a couple of other minor people in the village that are doing the people that have long conversations with him. But the kid doesn't speak.
It's implied that the kid is the resident expert in the resident village expert they've wheeled in, who does this for a living.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, that makes sense.
And the cardboard cutouts are there just to, so he's getting some visual feedback to go with the verbal that he's getting.
Right.
So I've got some questions written down. One of them is, from another point of view, you're watching this as a prisoner episode for the first time, and you're going, "What's going on?" Well, I recognise this episode is an allegory for other prisoner episodes. He is somebody apparently with a position of power or law, and he retires. Nobody knows why. They want him back. So that has got the parallels with the actual prisoner narrative.
Yeah.
For us, that makes total sense. Mm-hmm. But does it work the other way around? If you're watching this and you've not seen the prisoner before, you're going, well, this is not an allegory. It's just confusing. Does it work as a Western?
It does work as a Western, I think. Except that in a Western, it's very rare the good guy would actually die at the end. It does happen occasionally. And it's very powerful when it does, because it's not what you're expecting from the genre. Mm. But the way it plays out is, I mean, it's not dissimilar from High Noon. There's a clash coming, but the sheriff is refusing. Well, that's the wrong way around, because in High Noon, the sheriff knows he's got to do it, but nobody will help him. There's an element of that in this, but it does play out as a normal Western. The thing would be, if you'd not seen any other prisoner episode and this was the first prisoner episode you ever watched, you would be baffled I think by what you're watching
Think it was a Western, right?
Yeah. Until that cut out at the end, then you'd be like, what the hell is this?
Now, Michael, I've just been reminded of something. You're a big fan of auteur theory.
Well, I am. That's one of my things that's listed. I've got the words auteur, I've got punctums, and I've got tropes. Just as little words. Words that we never get to use. But yes, I am a big fan of it. So go
on. I mean, it's very clear when that caption flashes up, written, directed, and produced by David Tomlin, that we are in auteur territory. I mean, we've talked
Except
a lot about the fact...
Except we're not. Because... It says, basically, it implies from an idea by Ian R. L. Rankin.
Oh, right.
Now,
yeah, okay, yeah.
He'd turned up to Pat before things started going a bit weird and gone, in the lunch queue, apparently, and gone, I've got this idea for a story. Now, he works on the program as something quite low down.
Yeah.
And he comes up and goes, I've got this idea. Can I do it? And he went, yeah, you can present it. So he turns up and then he talks to... Pat McGoohan about it, and he gives him the not even a rough script, quite a detailed script, but Pat's just had a meeting with Lord Grade, and Pat rants for an hour about Lord Grade, and at the end of the meeting he goes, what about the script? You went, oh yeah, you've got it nearly all nailed, yeah, we're definitely doing that, and then he leaves the room, and that's it, and then the script gets given to Tomlin likes it, decides to do some rewrites, and then directed himself.
Yeah.
And then he basically takes over, and the guy gets a little bit annoyed that all of his hard work's just been kind of absorbed, and it ends up becoming from a screenplay by such and such, and, oh, yeah, some other one was involved. So it is auteur theory in this. On paper, you go, right, this is clearly some guy's vision, but what's actually happened is somebody's gone, that's a great idea, I'm going to run with it.
Right.
So yeah, I get it.
So it's more, it's more like yeah. Richard Curtis and Yesterday. If you know the story behind that.
No, no, I don't. Tell me more.
Oh, so basically, a much less known writer wrote a script for what became Yesterday. You know, the whole, like, everybody's forgotten who the Beatles are apart from this one guy who tries to pass the songs off as his own.
Isn't that Rodney in that time travel thing where in the 1940s?
Goodnight, Sweetheart.
In Goodnight, Sweetheart, because that's what he did all the way through.
Yes, but anyway, and then there was a slightly public Twitter kerfuffle with this guy kind of releasing his script going, look, I deserve more credit for this. Mm-hmm. And Richard Curtis going back and going, well, yes, we acknowledge that he wrote the original script, but then we changed. Anyway, so there's what you're saying is there's an element of that here.
According to the Alan Scott books, yeah.
And apparently Tomlin snuck it through because Patrick McGoohan was away filming Ice Station Zebra.
Mm.
While they were doing Do Not Forsake Me, My Darling, and then he presumably came back to, like, do this.
That's why the title for Do Not Forsake Me, My Darling, which was this title, was then used for that. Because the on the original script that was handed in for this, it was called Do Not Forsake Me, My Darling.
Really?
Like, oh, yeah. I'll have that title and move it over to there. And Living in Harmony is the replacement title, which is brilliant. Because even when I was 20, I was writing a radio script called Bloody Harmony about a split UK where half of it was a vegan and half of it was carnival. And in Birmingham was the new capital, which was Free City in the centre. Sorry, I've gone beyond a tangent.
Well, that's very much a tangent.
But Bloody Harmony, because I just loved the idea of living in harmony. And I lifted that from this as well. So there's too many titles being lifted. But yeah, that is the story of the title of the other story.
Can we go back to him not using a gun? Because and you as the Western aficionado, Tony, can comment on this. That aspect of the story strikes me as being very not in the mould of the Western. Am I right or am I wrong?
It is in some Westerns the lawman is unwilling to use his gun unless he's absolutely forced to. Mm-hmm. It's very rare that he has no weapon at all. But historically, and this is part of the research I did around the gunfighters, generally, there were no gunfights. Most of the time, what a sheriff would do if he was encountered somebody who was belligerent and drunk, they would pistol whip them. They wouldn't start shooting. They would literally smack them around the head with the butt of the gun.
Wow. Okay.
And the whole mythology of the West and Westerns is based on a false premise that people were fighting with guns all the time. They weren't. It was a very rare occurrence. And it's one of the reasons why the gunfight, the OK Corral, has become such a thing, because it was such a rare actual occurrence that people would shoot.
Didn't the Wild West itself last like 7 years?
Yeah, something like that. It's a ridiculously short period of time.
Yeah, and it's happening at exactly the same time that Queen Victoria is on the throne.
Well, also the other reason why...
Mind-blowing.
Yeah, and also... now I've got to remember names again when my 52-year-old brain dies on me. Wyatt Earp lived long enough to be an advisor on Western films in Hollywood, which is one of the reasons why that gunfight is so famous, because one of the people that was involved in it was still alive and could still tell his side of the story.
Right.
So it is a very short period of time, and it's relatively close to us.
It's become
a very mythologized period in American history.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't last very long, and because fundamentally, eventually, people want to be safe. So as soon as they go, let's have some law and order. And as soon as the law and order arrives in decent amounts, it's over.
Yeah. And I mean, I suppose the parallel for me is the Valley of Fear, the Sherlock Holmes story, because that is sort of set in a... Well, I guess it was set in a contemporary Sherlock Holmesy late 19th century time. And already in that, you've got like mining going on, and you've got the Pinkertons agency, and you've got some kind of law enforcement. And that feels very different from your out-and-out Western. But as you're saying, so much of what we think of as Westerns is a sort of mythologized version. I guess
it's mythology from mythology as well, because you've got the first wave, like you said, of Westerns that are just almost kind of historical documents. But then you've got that whole journey of the hero storylines going on, which then feeds into itself, resulting... do you know the story of how spaghetti Westerns got made not in America, and they didn't obey the American rules to do with decency, which is why they looked so different? And then they got made... Clint Eastwood was more than aware, because he'd been working on his own TV shows, Western ones, for years. But during the making of the spaghetti Westerns, he went, well, that's not going to be allowed. Oh, sod it, I'm not going to say anything. Let's just make this film. It looks great. So they were making films that were against the rules, but they were using the same, like, the tropes and the ideas and the concepts from earlier stuff. And those films were the next generation beyond the John Wayne era, yeah, the ones that were made in where they tested atomic weaponry. The spaghetti Westerns just played fast and loose with any historical documents, like who's the marshal, who's the sheriff, who's in charge. And yeah, but there's great moments in those Westerns where people are dressed in blue, but they're covered in grey dust, and then they're on the different side in the Civil War. Again, the Civil War aspect often feeds into the whole cowboy genre as well. And there's so much going on. But for me, they've become such an ingrained part of especially American culture that the history and the gun violence from the movies history rather than the real history, which, like we said, lasted 7 years tops, has become ingrained in their psyche as part of, like the people in this country have got kind of ingrained the dislike of the French and being Bowman and stuff like that from 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
900 years ago, it's still in our psyche. The Westerns, not even 150 years ago tops.
Yeah.
And that's ingrained in their psyche. And of course, that's part of the gun culture, which is a whole different podcast for another time.
Yeah.
So, it's also why. Yeah.
It's also that the Western is key to cinema in a way. I mean, one of the earliest surviving bits of cinema is the Great Train Robbery from 1903. Now, bear in mind that 1903 is probably 20 years from when this was actually real stuff. And so you kind of it's an interesting choice for a series being made in England. But then, as I said, the gunfight, Doctor Who's done it because Westerns are everywhere at this point in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. It's only in the 80s they really stopped being shown all the time.
And I guess, I mean, McGoohan himself leans into the American accent.
Yeah.
In it. Being like American born himself, but having grown up in the UK, he kind of leans into the whole American thing. And you, I mean, this is another thing. None of us are Americans. The accents in this feel more authentic than the non-American actors in The Gunfighters who are trying to do American accents.
Yeah.
They feel more kind of on the money in that sense, and he just fit them all. I guess to go back, just to kind of get the whole Western thing off my chest. I think the thing that I struggle with, and it applies in this, is that I don't instinctively get the rules of the world, if that makes sense. Like, you said there's a lot of tropes and stuff, so I guess you can kind of pick it up from. If you watch enough, it kind of makes sense. But I don't easily grasp, like, why does this world work this way? You know, and it, I suppose it's something to do with the kind of the lawlessness of it and the fact that it doesn't, the world doesn't behave in the way that we would expect it to behave. Like, when do you pull out your gun? Like, why do you shoot so-and-so? And why are there certain consequences for certain things and not for other things? And, like, why are they allowed to lynch the guy?
Why is there one woman
on the horse. Why? Well, no, okay, I noticed this time watching it, there's one other woman and one kid.
Right.
Briefly in the back of one shot. But yes, it is mostly just Kathy is like the woman in the back.
But there's a definite male slant across Westerns.
Yeah.
So what they've done is they've taken the concepts and the ideas. It's to make it feel like a Western.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what they've done. But is it a real Western or is it a fake Western in order to distract us for 40 minutes into seeing the power struggle with number six?
But I suppose I don't think that ultimately matters, does it? Because
however many
levels of artifice,
yeah,
there's at least one level of artifice because it's a hallucination, and we can then kind of go, well, there's how many other levels of artifice are on top of that?
Now the one thing that is missing from the normal episode of The Prisoner and all of the ideas that come out is at no point does he get interrogated about why he resigned.
Well, there's a kind of hint at it, isn't there?
Well, I must have missed it. That was kind of where I was going, because
when he has the first, I think the first conversation with the judge.
Yeah,
I think the judge basically says he doesn't say it bluntly, like why did you resign, but he basically says what, and the prisoner says, well, I was just going to go away, and it's done, but it's not done as a massive interrogation. It's just done as a kind of couple of casual questions.
Okay.
Yes. There's a parallel between he's left his previous job and he's going on a holiday.
Yeah.
That's kind of there.
Well, see, I was using that more as my leaning towards my idea that of who he is at the end.
Yeah.
It's because it doesn't. There's so many levels going on that they just didn't bother asking about his why he resigned.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they were more interested in just breaking him and bringing him over to another side.
Yeah. Can I talk about Rover?
Rover in this episode. Okay.
Well, this is my. Well, so I was thinking about this in that essentially because this is a Western, that you can't have Rover. And so they have to set up. There's obviously however many dudes lying in wait.
Mm.
So whichever direction he goes on a horse, they're going to catch him. And yet, when he escapes the second time, he successfully overpowers all of those people in a way that he wouldn't be able to overpower Rover. And it's only because he comes back for Kathy that he doesn't escape. And it's an interesting kind of what if, you know, like what would have happened if he had just ridden off?
Well, I don't think he leaves. I don't think he leaves the bar set, well, the town set at any point. I think all the riding out bit. I think all the riding out bits and the fights out there are hallucinated. Are told to him by the kid, and which might explain why the countryside looks so much like the British countryside, because it's an illusion, and they're trying to loosely describe it as much as. I mean, the issue I have with this episode, is, to some small degree, I think if you just accept it and go along with it, is the amount of talking that would have to be done to convince him of what's happening seems excessive, and the amount of hallucinogens you'd have to take to be convinced like that, I think, might break you mentally forever.
Because you're basically giving
him a bad trip.
So,
but it's a bad trip with a construction, and the construction is the Western genre, and they've clearly chosen it because it's something that number six can relate to. He's forgotten who he is. He's completely forgotten his life as a spy or an engineer or whatever you want to say he originally was, or the original orchestrator of the village or whoever you think he was.
Yeah.
It's gone. He is a marshal with his own memories of being a marshal, which is weird, but only if you're like us and we think about it.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, and this had never occurred to me until I listened to Stephen and Erica's podcast years ago when they did it, is that this and Once Upon a Time are sort of two sides of the same coin. In that, in Living in Harmony, you see the hallucination, right? You are in it with him until the point where the hallucination breaks. Whereas, Once Upon a Time, you are with number two and you're seeing that room from number two's point of view, while number two takes him through a whole bunch of scenarios, right?
Yeah.
And we don't see things from number six's perspective in Once Upon a Time, but one can assume that he is having similar sets of experiences. I mean, obviously, he's not in one hallucination for the whole thing. He's in a whole series of things because he gets... Spoilers for people who haven't watched that episode yet, but we're going to be talking about it in 2 weeks. He gets regressed through a whole series of his own life. And they're kind of two sides of the same coin. In this instance, we're seeing it from his point of view. In that instance, we're seeing it from number two's point of view. But they're essentially doing the same thing to him. They're kind of putting him into scenarios that they want to put him into to break him.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, number six's sense of his own identity must be incredibly strong.
Yes.
Because he never actually breaks.
Yeah. So can I just say the one thing that irritates me in this episode happens in the end, and you've got Kathy's death, you've got the burial. Oh my God, how good does that shot look when he's standing in the graveyard with the silhouettes? And I was like, that's a nice thing. There's some beautiful use of lighting. Clearly they'd all gone down and gone, right, we've seen westerns, we can do that, we can create that. And they do go out of their way to do it's the extreme close-ups, the there's a lot of spaghetti western kind of camera work in this. But Kathy goes, as she's been strangled for no adequately explored reason, I wish it had been real. And it was like, because I thought I'd forgotten that she apparently doesn't make it out the episode alive. She says, I wish this had been real. And I was thinking, well, you would be dead because you died in the other story. You're an idiot. And then she dies, and you're like, what? And that did irritate me.
I think the it that she's referring to, and Tony, you can agree with me or disagree with me on this. The it that she's referring to is her connection with number six. Her connection with the unnamed sheriff that number six is playing. Because she is the reason that he does everything that he does. Right? Pretty much.
Yeah.
Or rather, if she wasn't there, he would have acted in a completely different way, right? Because he feels a protective nature towards her. I mean, there's no real hint of a romance between them, because we don't have that in The Prisoner, apart from when he's Nigel Stock. But I think that's what she's referring to. She is upset once they're back in the real world, because and we don't know anything else about her, do we? We don't know who she is. We just know that she is a villager who is part of the scheme.
In
the same way that, like, you could have like a holodeck episode of Star Trek where a character would rather stay in the holodeck than be, or this is a crazy thing, Red Dwarf, Lister in Back to Earth, which is obviously kind of generally the nadir of Red Dwarf, but there's a point where Lister has to choose to kind of stay in the hallucinogenic world or leave it, because and there's a point where he's staying, and then he chooses to leave, and you kind of feel that Kathy would rather that world had persisted. Probably because it was happier for her. I mean, messy and horrible western-wise there it was, and that she's basically saying, I would rather that world and our connection had persisted.
The bit that I get most irritated about is in that final part, which is, I'm not convinced that jumping off that point would kill you. When the kid, or Alex Kenner's character, throws himself off the top, off that first floor to the floor, I'm not convinced that fall is big enough to kill you.
No.
I think you could hurt you. It would hurt you. And I think if you were unlucky, it would kill you. But I don't think it's big enough a fall to actually kill you.
No, you're completely right. I don't get the strangulation, the motivation behind it, really. It feels a bit forced. But Alex Kenner's death, and then perhaps his reappearance at some other point does make sense.
No, I think Alex Kenner and the Alex Kenner's character and the number whatever 20, the Katie's character. Yeah, okay. I think they both prefer, for whatever reason, the false world to the real world, and the Alex Kenner gets sucked into that story and snaps as a result. This is what I mean by the prison number six breaks them all. I mean, number two, my favorite moment in the episode is when you cut to them all standing in number two's office, and she's crying and they're talking about what's happened, and the number six walks in, and he's you can see he's raging, and he's clearly gonna say, and then he just looks at them and just kind of goes and just turns around and goes out without saying a word. And I just think that's such a brilliant, it's basically more, even more insulting to them than it would be if he'd raged at them. They could probably kind of, they go, oh, well, we got something out of this because we got him annoyed enough to thing. Yeah. But he actually just goes, I'm not even gonna.
It's like I'm so disappointed in you. I'm so disappointed.
I could see I've won. Looking at you, I could see I've won. What do I have to say? I'm just gonna go.
I'll tell you one thing about this episode. You cannot just put it on in the background and get on with something else, like some of the more talkative episodes. I think there's less text in, less actual dialogue in this than there is in the episode where he spends most of the thing inside of a trunk. It's just really, so you've got to watch it. You can't just shove it on and have it on in the background going, oh yeah, I'll make some notes as we go. Yeah. You go, no, I've got to sit here and focus, so I've got all my notes made.
So before we land with Spot the Doctor Who actor, anybody have anything else to say about Living in Harmony as we wrap up?
The only thing that I have in my notes is not even that worthy of note, but the actor who plays Chunky Gilmore was being interviewed on a Big Finish Extra, and they were saying, what sort of thing would you be interested in? He said, well, to be fair, I don't really like sci-fi, but I would love to have been in a Western. And I do get the feeling that that's kind of what McGowan did with this. He went, you know, I've not really done a Western. This is my excuse. Well, this is my, I'm spending Lord Grade's money. Let's just go for it. And that's how this happened, because I don't think he's in any other Western to my knowledge. So maybe that's all it is. It's just, you're of a certain age, you grew up with Westerns. Let's just
do it. You want to be in a Western?
Yeah.
I think the one last thing I would say is I think it's the most real and brutal ending to any Prisoner episode.
Yes. It is pretty brutal, isn't it?
Because it's not what you kind of still expect him to save her in the real world as he did and he doesn't, and she gets murdered and is just lying on the floor. Yeah. And then the kid, Alex Kenner's character, just throws himself off a thing and kills himself. And it's
precise opposite of what happens 5 minutes earlier.
Yeah.
Because the number six is dead on the floor. And then when he wakes up, everybody else ends up dead, and number six ends up striding out of the bar like the end of a proper cowboy film.
Yeah.
The lone hero walking off into the sunset.
And number two is just left standing there looking at how bad his failure is.
Definitely.
So,
yeah.
On that note, Spot the Doctor Who actor. there are two. Did you spot any?
Oh, you know I didn't. Well,
I recognised a lot of faces, but I didn't do my normal, I'm sure he was in an episode of Doctor Who, I'm going to check. I'm pretty convinced that, the guy who played the the Spanishy person with the moustache and the gap teeth. I've seen lots of things, but I'm not entirely convinced he was in Doctor Who.
He was not in Doctor Who.
He's in Zulu. He was, or in, Zulu
he was
Dawn.
In, he was in an episode of UFO, which Michael and I have already covered, but he never did Doctor Who. So, he's not.
The only other one I thought... There's the other guy that's face is very familiar, because I think he's been in pretty much everything. So if he hadn't been in Doctor Who, I'd be very surprised. Is the guy that the kid kills in the bar... the older guy,
the one who
looks a bit Ernest Borgnine-y.
The one with the moustache.
Yeah, he's talking to Kate. Yeah, he's talking to Katie,
and then he goes to talk to McGowan on his own, and then he comes back to the bar and gets killed.
No, the one that's okay. He's talking to Katie in the bar. Something good's happened to him, and he's talking to Katie in the bar, and the kid takes a dislike to him and. Shoots
oh,
him.
Oh, him. Yeah, okay. No, not him. Not him. No. No. So the two that we have, and I didn't spot the one that I should have spotted. So the Gordon Stern, who is credited as bystander, he is the guy that goes to number six on his own. And then he comes back to the bar and he gets killed because he's been obviously disloyal to the judge.
Yeah.
He has a very small role in The Ambassadors of Death as Heldorf, who is the first scientist that looks after the ambassadors before he gets murdered by Regan. And I only know that because I happen to have watched The Ambassadors of Death quite recently. And when I saw him, I was like... And he looks very different, so it wouldn't be a case of... But when I looked at the cast list and I was like, I recognise your name. Why do I recognise your name? And then I looked at him and was like, yeah. So that's he is one. And then the other, and I didn't spot him because if I had spotted him, I would have known. But Max Faulkner apparently is in this. He's credited as first horseman. So clearly he's one of the horsemen. But you will know him, I mean, as a Havoc stuntman extraordinaire.
I was going to say, this is... Because wasn't he McGowan's... stuntman, and this is the only time he's like listed.
Frank Mayer plays one of the other horsemen. Max Faulkner is in lots of things, as a unit soldier and all that kind of stuff. You will see him kind of getting punch ups with Pertwee and all that kind of stuff. But in terms of his credits as an actor, he is also in The Ambassadors of Death. He's the guard who holds on to the pole when the alien comes and zaps him. He's a miner in The Monster of Peladon. He's a Thal guard in The Genesis of the Daleks. And then, most famously, he's the android that falls into the quarry at the beginning of Android Invasion and then comes back to life because he's an android. And then he is one of the outsiders in The Invasion of Time. So he's a Time Lord who gave up on being a Time Lord. I didn't spot him in this at all. But he clearly is in it.
I didn't. His face is incredibly familiar to me.
Yes.
So I'm surprised I didn't spot him.
No, so he must have been such a minor part in this.
There were lots of faces. Like, a lot of the cast I thought I knew from places. When I looked up the guy that I was talking about in the bar that gets killed, I mean, he is literally in about 40 different British TV series over a period of time.
Yeah.
So his face was very familiar. But I didn't really. It's quite a small cast, obvious cast in this one, though, isn't it? There aren't lots of people in it.
Not many speaking roles, no.
Speaking roles. So it's quite hard. I did think actually all the main cast were pretty good. I think Alex Kenner is genuinely quite disturbing.
Yeah.
He is just. Yeah, weird in everything that he's in. And it's not a spoiler, I think, to say, and we've alluded to it, that he... Well, we've already had him in the episode that we will talk with you about next week. He has a very small role in that. And then he has a much bigger role in Fallout, the final episode. Which, you were alluding to that earlier, Michael, weren't you? That is he supposed to be the same character resurrected?
I'm thinking so, yeah.
But we will talk about that in 2 weeks' time. No, 3 weeks' time.
Eventually.
When we get to Fallout.
At the end.
Dear listener. But
listeners are going to have me for 2 weeks on the trot, I have realised.
No, they're not poor listeners. You've been a great guest, anyway. We've loved having you on.
Yeah. You've talked more about, made more sense about Westerns than I've thought in years.
Yeah.
When I went to university, the first thing they do, they sit you down and they went, and now you're doing film studies. Here's Shane. And it instantly puts almost everybody off Westerns immediately because you're watching something that was dated even when it was made. And everyone's like, oh, it's one of the greatest Westerns of all time. And you're like, seriously, have you seen the calendar? What? So, yeah, thank you for reigniting just a bit more interest in the Western.
I think I could, I'm not an expert, but I have grown to like the genre I loved it when I was a kid because I used to watch it with my nan. It was quite nice, and we used to watch like Bonanza and stuff like that. But I've watched a lot of them over the years, and I think, as I said, I think the best Westerns are amongst the best films ever made. Hmm. And like, for example, I'm just trying to think. Well, my brain just, as I get older, my brain is turning to like a colander and it has huge holes in it where there used to be information. I think as well, if you look at Westerns, not just the American ones and not just the old American ones, you get a much broader spread of what's... I mean, as you said, Luke, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly is... I've seen it on the big screen and it is one of the greatest films ever made, in my opinion. But there's so much out there, and I think it's like anything that's a genre. I think that you can pigeonhole as one type of thing is always going to suffer in the long run, and especially because really in recent years Westerns have dropped quite low down the people. They make Clint Eastwood makes one every so often, and there's been a few. There's like Yellowstone now, which apparently is very, which is a sort of what pseudo Western really. Mm. Which I mean to watch, and I've not got around to it. I enjoyed, but that's not the only reason I enjoy this episode. I enjoy this episode because I like it when I know they were just filling time effectively because they'd had to create another four or five episodes that they weren't planning to do. But I think sometimes when you're forced into a box, you come up with interesting ideas because you can't, you need to do something and you haven't got time to think about what you're going to do. You just have to do it. Yeah. And I think this has got some beautiful shots in it. And I like the way as well, when he wakes up, the style of the camera work changes. It goes back to being like a prisoner episode.
Yes.
That you get those weird close-ups. You get those really sort of weird close-ups on Patrick McGuinn's face when he's like kind of staring into this, that kind of thing, that weren't in the Western part of it. And the cinematography, the direction changes as soon as you get into that.
Yeah. Well, maybe our conversation will help me appreciate it more next time.
I could do you a list of 10 Westerns I would recommend you watch.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a great idea. And maybe we could post that in the show notes when we release this episode. But until then, thank you again for being with us, Tony. Listeners, you will hear him again next week. And as ever, thank you, Michael.
No, thank you. I've genuinely enjoyed it. So shall we sign off in the traditional fashion where I just say, be seeing you.